broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host for the day, Louis van Copenhagen, and joining me in the studio today is Joel Hewish.
Morning, Louis.
And Brett Dickinson.
G'day, guys.
Our resident experts.
Good to hear.
Fantastic. So, it's another week in the world.
That it is, indeed.
Yep.
It is, it is. I've got a piece of news that came out this week about our industry or related to it. It's about the number of people who are in the financial advice industry. More to the point, the number of people who have left the financial advice industry.
The exodus.
It is a bit of an exodus. And you would think that it's a natural happening as a result of the Royal Commission.
Most likely, there's some blowback.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely some blowback from there. But there's some other pressures on the financial advice industry as well. And this is going to before the Royal Commission. And the pressure that's happening at the moment is the increase in expectations of advisors and the new requirement of education requirements.
It's significant. Right. Yep.
It is significant. So beyond the year 2024... Every financial advisor will have to have a university-level qualification, which is not the case at the moment.
Okay. Which I think longer term is a good thing, but what you're seeing probably is the fact that a lot of those old advisors that have been around for 20, 30 years that came in as ex-lifeies, life insurance salespeople, well, they're probably thinking, what's the point?
Yeah.
Would that be fair to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, fair
probably
to say.
Probably not wanting to undergo a whole new... load of training and education.
Yeah, yeah. If you've been basically, doing this for 20 or 30 years and you're getting towards the end of your career, what's the... and you only got another 2, 3, 4 years left in the industry.
You're not going to reinvest in yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also people who are in business where financial advice is not the core of their business. Maybe they're an accountant and they have the ability to provide financial advice on the side, because the education requirement is not just to have a university degree, but to have a relevant university degree specific to financial planning.
So what are the numbers, Louis? Who's leaving? How much are leaving? And
well, there's about 28,000 financial advisors in Australia.
Right.
Or at least there were.
Yeah.
Because 2,825 have ceased operation in the last 12 months.
10%.
So it's 10%.
10% of financial advisors have got out of the industry in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
That's right. Wow. That's right.
That's significant.
It is significant. And because of the new requirements being phased in for new advisors coming in... the number of new advisors is 19.
19
new advisors.
Wow.
And one of the things I love about articles like this is the comments section.
Yeah.
Because financial advisors, we're still people. And whenever there's people, there's whingers and complainers. Yeah. And I love reading the comments about, the regulators are killing the industry and it's the death of us. The comment I really enjoyed was someone saying, I'm surprised that 19 people actually joined this industry.
There's always a bit of banter in those comments.
Yeah, there is. There is. But I mean, for us as a business, I think it's great news because Joel, you've already got a university degree, which is related. I've already got a university degree, which is related. Mm-hmm. So as far as being authorized representatives, we're covered.
Yes, we are.
But what does it mean for the industry as a whole going forward? Does it mean less people will have access to advice? The price of advice might increase if there's less people facilitating?
Probably that would be the logical next step.
I think it's important to note, though, that I think the regulators wanted this. They wanted to get rid of the fringe the fringe advisors.
They wanted to lift the standards.
They want to lift the standards. They want to get rid of those advisors who aren't at the education levels that that is going to take the industry forward into the future and actually create this into a true profession.
Mm. Mm. Yep. Yep, that's right. I'd agree with that. And another thing which the regulators are trying to do, I think, is reduce the number of small licensees. So for our listeners who don't know...
We'd get big quick then, eh?
That's right. A financial services license is almost like the compliance and back office of any financial advisor, which is often done by either a large group or within a business if they have their own license. It's almost like a separate set of things that needs to be done.
Correct. Yeah.
So what the regulator has said they don't want is smaller licenses with only a few advisors where they don't have good processes and it's all a bit ad hoc. Their preference is for businesses with larger resources and better business systems and more regular processes so that there is better quality control in it, ultimately, for the consumers who are getting the financial advice.
The main reason is they see that the cost of compliance and meeting your obligations for your license is quite significant, and therefore it's hard for a smaller business to justify that expense, so they may cut corners or may miss their obligations.
Yep, that's right. Yep. And even if you've got a business which is one or two financial advisors who are also running their own license, they're trying to do two jobs at the one time.
Yeah. There's just not enough hours.
That's right, just not enough hours. Correct. And if they get lots of clients to deal with, then same thing, Brett, they might cut corners or they might put all their time into servicing clients rather than meeting compliance requirements.
Yep, easy to do.
So it doesn't mean it'll happen, but they've outlined that there's a high risk of that happening.
High risk,
in
that's
store.
Right.
Which
undermines the professionalism of the industry.
Yep. So ASIC have said, well, if there's going to be problems, it's probably going to be with the smaller licenses. Mm-hmm. And also, for us to do our job, we would like to have less people to have to... provide oversight to.
I find that kind of funny too, that they've identified the smaller licenses as the potentially risky ones, when if you look at the Royal Commission, it was all the major organisations that really had the significant impact.
Exactly. So look, on that, for the first time ever, the number of licensees that discontinued was higher than the number of new licensees that opened up.
That's interesting. You'll probably see mergers as well, with you know, those smaller firms perhaps merging with one another to create some scale that they perhaps didn't have previously. I know with our business, we've actually just completed a fee review, unfortunately, which has gone through and started this financial year as a result of these changes and the cost of compliance. And we're out there now looking for a dedicated compliance officer to join UGC. So if anyone out there is listening to this who has experience, please get in touch with us at 03-8657-7640. We'd like to have a chat. Yeah,
compliance officer with experience.
Yes, with experience, please.
Thank you. Yep.
But it's certainly, we're seeing the changes, we're seeing the shifts, we're seeing the cost increases. You know, right now I'd be concerned if I was an IFA, an independent financial advisor with a license, that isn't treating this seriously, because right now ASIC have copped it off the back of the Royal Commission, and they're looking to try and, you know, nail some people.
Mm, absolutely. So there are some different, I guess, categories that you could split financial advisors. You could say that some are independent.
Mm.
You could say that some are aligned. And you could say that some are institutional.
Mm. Yep.
So an institutional financial advisor is someone who's employed by a financial institution, maybe with Macquarie, maybe with one of the banks. Mm. An aligned financial advisor might be a licensee that's branded to look separate,
mm-hmm.
but actually has some kind of ownership or association with a particular financial institution. For example, Financial Wisdom.
Yep.
They're not independent. They're completely owned by Commonwealth Bank.
Mm. Right.
Godfrey Pembroke is completely owned by the NAB. Millennium 3 is owned by IOOF.
Okay. Yeah.
So they're product providers who have said, well, let's also own a license so that we can... when they started doing it, they wanted to say, we want to control the approved product list that these so-called independent but not really independent
yeah.
advisors could recommend product.
Yeah. yeah.
So that's how they got into it. And then there is the category of actually independent financial advisors where they're not owned or specifically aligned with a particular product provider.
Which is where we fit in.
Which is yeah. where we fit in. Which doesn't mean that we don't prefer a particular product provider, because
of course,
when we do our research, yeah. well, we come up with a list. Well, who is the best at doing what they do?
Yeah.
We do have to use financial products
yep.
For our clients to get investment returns or manage their super funds
yep.
And so or have their insurance policies.
Yep.
So we know the people with good products at good pricing with yep. decent levels of service.
And we have the freedom to go and engage with those product providers.
Yeah. And the yep. flexibility to pick and choose from any of them.
Yeah.
Yep.
The classic is, you know, if you go to Macquarie, they're going to put you into a Macquarie wrap. You know, if you go to BT, if you go to a Westpac advisor, yeah. they're going to put you into a BT wrap. Mm-hmm. If you go to a Colonial First State, it's going to be first choice wrap.
When you use the word wrap, Joel, what are you referring to?
It's a platform where investors, essentially where the financial advisors will aggregate the administration and reporting of investments to their clients. It's technology enabled so that you can track, you know, shares, manage funds, cash, term deposits on the mm-hmm. On the one investment platform.
Mm. Yep,
but they still charge fees for it.
Yeah. Yes, they do. So, and just on that, gone are the days where any financial advisor gets a commission from investments. That doesn't happen anymore.
Nope, that's right.
There might be a legacy if someone's held on to their still got the same product as 5 or 10 or 20 years ago,
yeah.
there might still be an ongoing commission there. But these days, when you see a financial advisor, there are no commissions on investments or on super. There is on life insurance, but it's the same rate of commission across all the different insurance companies.
Yeah. Just want to qualify that. So there are no commissions on managed investment schemes. There are no commissions on managed funds and these types of products. However, the stockbroking industry is exempt from commissions. There are still commissions on stocks that are capital raised, capital raisings for companies. So that is still allowed.
Right. Thank you, Joel.
And in fact, one of the ways that a lot of brokers and financial advisors were still earning commissions on products was through the listed investment company route, where fund managers were, and there was a bit of a boom in listed investment companies coming to the market just last year and the year before, where fund managers were opting to become listed investment companies rather than managed investment schemes, where they could still pay commissions on the capital raising.
Right, they figured a workaround.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a potential rort where a fund manager might launch just a new fund every 3 months or something like that.
Yep.
Let's raise it into a new fund and then invest it the same way as all of our other funds.
Correct.
But we can just pay commissions through that loophole.
Correct. Mm. Correct.
Thank you for clarifying, Joel. So, look, on that, we've got numbers here for the number of advisors who have left the industry.
Mm.
I don't have the number of advisors who have shifted from one segment to another, but I do have percentages.
Yeah, sure. Right.
So the number of independent advisors was actually up very slightly.
Okay.
Not by much, but very slightly. Which means the 10% of advisors who left the industry as a net result have come out of the institutions and aligned financial advisors.
The ones who copped it the most in the Royal Commission.
Yeah. So as far as people leaving the industry, people might not be leaving the industry as a result of the Royal Commission. That might be more the education standards that are coming in.
Yeah.
But as a result of the Royal Commission, people are leaving the institutional and the aligned advising businesses.
And on that note, Louis, weren't some of the institutions selling off or distancing themselves with their advice arms? Was that part of what was coming about?
Yes, some.
There has been.
The big ones to go first were actually more the funds management arms,
yeah,
and the insurance arms, where they're the product providers,
yeah,
and a little bit in the financial advice space. But you know what? I don't think their financial advice businesses ever made much money.
No, they didn't.
Anyway,
no.
and a lot of the time they would actually run them at a loss.
Yeah.
Because it gave them the distribution of their products.
Correct. Yeah. The value was in having the advisors selling the products, and then they make a ton of money having the products. Mm. So the fund management business was making the money, while the advice business, well, if we're making all this money on funds management that comes from the advice, we don't have to make any money on the actual advice.
Correct.
So there's not really too much of a saleable asset in that segment.
So it's pretty easy to argue, and I think anyone listening would see the value in your advisor being independent for the reasons we've outlined.
Yeah.
How can they tell if one is or isn't? If they meet one, if they want to know about their current one, how would they be able to ascertain the position of that advisor in those categories you mentioned?
There's actually, ASIC actually define what an independent financial advisor actually is, and the terms to actually use that word independent are actually, that is actually a restricted term these days under legislation. So you can't call yourself an independent financial advisor unless you meet a certain set of criteria.
Okay, so I could ask a financial advisor, are you independent? And they have to be honest about that.
Well, unless they meet that criteria, it's actually a breach of regulation. I don't know exactly what the criteria is, but it's pretty rigid and it's pretty hard to meet that criteria.
Yep, absolutely. So it's interesting to see some of these things come out, and then what they're expecting in the future is, well, a bit more continuation. The new education standards, they're being phased in between now and 2024. So we definitely are expecting more people to leave the industry than to come in, because there is a bigger barrier for new people to get into the industry. So it's going to take some time for people to meet that new requirement and then be able to get in as a new financial advisor.
So does that mean the forecast for the total number of advisors across the country is likely to fall more?
I think it's going to fall more, yes. A lot of people think it's going to fall more, especially as it gets closer and closer to 2024, when the requirement for a university degree comes in. There's requirements to sit a competency exam, and that requirement is by the end of next year. So we'll see people dropping out in the short term for those who don't want to sit an exam just to assess their skills. And there's also an ethics component to that exam. I'm not sure how you put ethics in an exam.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But they've tried.
Well, I guess it's to make sure you understand the ethics and what they are, because if you don't understand them, you can't live them.
At least I know what an ethic is.
Yeah, whether you'll do it or not is another thing, but
Yeah. So, watch this space for the number of financial advisors and make sure you're confident and comfortable with your advisor.
Mm. Yeah. Just circling back, I've just pulled up what the definition of an independent financial advisor is, or independent financial advice. So legally, to be able to claim that they are independent, a financial advisor must not receive commissions from a product issuer, receive remuneration based on the volume of business they place with the issuer of a financial product or service, accept gifts from a product issuer that might influence them, have any product restrictions imposed on them by their licensee, nor have any association with either a financial product or financial product issuer.
So it's not just about the ownership, it's about the alignment and the kickbacks as
correct.
Well.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Joel.
Yeah.
We'll get into our actual topics for the day. Joel, why don't you give us an update on the markets and what's been happening?
Yes, well, it is earnings season in the US. Right now, we've had about 52% of S&P 500 companies have reported their earnings for the second quarter of 2019. Now, so far, going into the quarter, analysts were expecting a decline in earnings of around about 2.7%. Now, that's... Mm-hmm. At the moment, earnings are tracking at around about 2.3% as a decline. So it's beating expectations, but it's still a decline.
Okay.
Of those companies that have reported, around 75% of those companies have beaten their expectations. So quite clearly what's happened is that companies knew this quarter wasn't going to be a good quarter. They've lowered guidance down, so they've guided the analysts lower than where they expected earnings to be, and obviously come in and beaten those expectations, which, you know, around 75% of an earnings beat is generally the long-term expectations. Companies do a good job of guiding low and then trying to beat higher and trying to get a pop in their share price.
Okay.
Now, revenues have grown on aggregate by 3.2%. So even though earnings are down, revenues are still growing. So that's a good sign. Yeah. Revenues tend to be a good leader for earnings growth.
Mm, okay.
Now, in the third quarter, though, expectations for earnings growth is for a further decline, 1.9%, based on the same quarter last year. So we're still expecting a negative earnings growth for the next quarter as well, or the current one that we're in.
Yep.
But then later on in the year, in the fourth quarter, earnings are expected to start rising again. And also currently expecting earnings to grow by 4.9% in the fourth quarter compared to the fourth quarter last year. And for the first quarter of 2020, earnings growth is expected to be 9.2%. Now, this is pretty consistent with where we're seeing the market at this point in time in a bit of a... we're starting to see markets lose a little bit of puff. Now, we know that share prices over the medium to longer term are directly related to the profits that companies produce. And as profits rise, so do share prices. As profits decline, so do share prices. With earnings not expected to do too much, certainly this quarter that we've just completed and the current quarter that we're in, there's a good chance that analysts and investors will probably sit on the sidelines here, not prepared to bid up share prices until they start to see some evidence that that fourth quarter growth in expected earnings is actually coming to fruition.
Hmm.
So just for investors, this is a period of time where we may see share prices just oscillate 5%, 8%, going up and down and not really going anywhere, particularly as we move into the September and October months of the year, which are typically the worst months for share price performance of the year. But beyond that, we will hopefully get that earnings growth coming through, and all things being equal, later on this year, early into next year, share price performances should start to improve and strengthen if that earnings growth does come through.
Thanks for that, Joel. A lot of interesting information. We will take a break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, listeners. Joel, you've got another interesting story of a segment
just
of
very, yes,
the market.
Yes, I do, Louis. So just very quickly, it's not all doom and gloom out there. There are some actual real hot spots in the market. And in fact, probably the hottest sector right now, particularly on the ASX, is the buy now, pay later space.
Oh, yeah. Afterpay, those sort
Afterpay,
of things.
Afterpay, Zip. Yeah. We actually have an own, we actually own Zip, or our clients own Zip, and it's a recommendation for our clients here at UGC. But there's been a new IPO that just came out this week on Tuesday, Sezzle. It's a Minneapolis-based company that's focused more on the United States and Canadian markets, so where Afterpay and Zip basically had their foundations in Australia. Sezzle listed on the ASX at $1.22 on Tuesday. That was its IPO price, and it closed on the day at $2.20 for an 80% or more than 80% increase on its IPO.
Wow.
On its first day of trading.
That's a big profit in a day.
That's right. And there is another company that the name escapes me at the moment. Payrite. That's right. Payrite, which is a private company at this point in time, but it's also completed a substantial amount of capital raising as well. The number escapes me, but...
and they're looking to IPO as well? Is that part of their raising now is to get ready for that?
Raising now, yeah. And they've been able to get their hands on it. It'd be somewhere around about $50 million worth of capital. It was about $25 million worth of capital in recent times to get that business off the ground.
Mm.
probably likely to see another IPO come out sometime soon with that particular business. But just a word of caution. I mean, it's a hot sector right now. Yep. Afterpay is grabbing a lot of headlines. Zip is grabbing a lot of headlines. And we've got competition coming in quite fast and strong. That's not to, to ring the bell on the share price performance of these companies, but they're certainly hot and they're certainly trading at fairly hefty valuations. Mm-hmm. So I think that you really need to be perhaps just assessing whether or not now's the right time to be making an investment and how much you might make as an investment in these types of businesses at these current levels if you haven't already made an investment.
Reminds me a little bit, about 10 years ago, there was the boom of all of the daily deal sort of sites, Groupon and Scoopon, yep. and all of them came about. And then suddenly there was all these new entrants into the market and all these indicative valuations and people wanting to get behind them. And then obviously over time it matures and it shakes out and only a few survive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I imagine with this space, it's going to be something similar because, I mean, how many of them can really own the market or be in, you know, can they all still play in the market and make profit?
Yeah, and it'll be interesting. And I think that there would be some form of network effect with these types of businesses where eventually the top one or the top two, you know, end
buy
up
being, the others
yeah, or end up being the dominant players. Because yep. at the end of the day, you've still got to get the retailers on board.
Mm.
They've got to accept your terminals and your, you know, method of payment.
Yep.
You know, over time, you know, how many different forms of payment, pay now, pay later, do retailers want to be dealing with?
Yeah.
And what about the consumers? Ultimately, they'll pick one, maybe two of their best, and the other, you know, two or three will probably be forgotten about. So right now, I think that my preference, if I was looking at this space, would still be with the two dominant players, Afterpay, which is by far the biggest, and then yep. Zip as the next up-and-comer, as these guys are like Sezzle and PayRider coming from a fair way behind.
And they all offer pretty much the same thing. There's not an opportunity or a value proposition that's different to the other.
Yeah, so Afterpay is much smaller amounts of credit. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's a few hundred dollars where I think that their points of differentiation with Zip, I think Zip will lend you up to around about $2,000 where Afterpay is sub $1,000.
Yeah.
And then you've now got Sezzle, which is saying, okay, we'll offer you maybe $1,000, maybe a touch around $1,000 higher. So their points of differentiation is just how much they're prepared to lend to you.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. That's all I can sort of decipher anyway.
Mm. Okay, very interesting. Thank you, Joel. Let's kick it over to Brett now.
Brett, lots to talk about.
Lots to talk about. Yeah, Brett, you've got some news stories?
Yeah.
Are they actual stories?
Well, some are. A few headlines that have come out in the last week, so I thought it's worth covering off because there was a fair few headlines that I thought were worth touching on. So rather than spend a lot of time on one particular topic, I thought we'll sort of traverse a few. Wanted to start with the first one, though, based on a conversation I had just a couple of days ago and in line with your conversations of late, Louis, about debt being your friend.
Mm.
And I'd implore anyone that has a home loan to listen up to this because we discussed with a broker the other day that refinanced a client into a home loan at 2.99%.
What?
2.99%.
Wow. Is that a honeymoon rate? Or?
No, I'm not 100%. No, he said he can actually get fixed rates for 5 years in the threes now as well.
Whoa.
So okay. Basically what that means, if your home loan rate doesn't have a three in front of it, you're out of the market and you're costing yourself thousands of dollars.
Yeah, wow.
So
that's
I'd implore
huge.
You to get in touch with a good broker who can have a look at your refinancing scenario. And if you don't know one, speak to us. We'll put you in touch with the guys that know it. So, yeah, as you say, Louis, debt's your friend. It's even more your friend when you're paying less for it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So it's a sign that obviously the, you know, the RBA's lowering of interest rates is starting to flow through.
Mm, absolutely.
So good sign there. The rest of the news I've got, though, is kind of conflicting, and I'm sort of trying to put a crystal ball together to say, how is all this going to play out for what the market's going to do? So the interesting things that have come about. So first of all, market performance. So CoreLogic release every month their data on whether median prices have risen or dropped. And overall, they're saying that the market's increased over the last quarter and the last month. And for the first time since the decline started about 18 months ago, we've had consecutive months of price growth in Melbourne and Sydney.
Okay.
So overall, we're seeing that, you know, the property market's stabilised, and if anything's starting to recover, now in conflict to that in terms of the overall market position, building approvals are significantly low at the moment, or they've dropped quite a bit. So the significant amount of approvals, so looking at some stats here, right, so approvals in June fell by more than 20% from their level last year.
In just 12 months.
In just 12 months.
Jeez.
Okay, and that was a 1.3% decline from the month before. So that's obviously on a downward trend. But if you compare those declines over a series of years, it's actually worse than that, because the 2018-19 financial year, there are 187,000 approvals in total. The year prior, there were 232,000. So we've gone, if we've dropped 20% from the 18-19 financial year, and that dropped 30-odd% from the year before, we're actually a long way down on a few years ago.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So when I said sort of trying to figure out how do we crystal ball this, so a lot of the data in the market and a lot of the impetus on the demand side, like easing of lending restrictions, obviously population growth we're still seeing is strong and forecast to be strong. So there's still going to be high demand for residential property. But the supply side looks like it's going to decline for a bit. So I'm looking at these two factors and saying, well, at some point in time, the demand is going to outstrip the supply. If the supply is drying up, the approvals are lower.
Yeah.
By the time those approvals are actually built and the demand keeps increasing, there'll be a point where there has to be some price growth.
Yeah.
So I'm forecasting, and this is my crystal balling scenario, and obviously nothing's guaranteed because the demand still needs to be validated with, you know, people being able to get access to finance, which looks like they can, but also wages growth and employment are going to play in. But the way all this is heading, I would imagine that in 12 to 18 months, we're actually going to see that demand will be greater than supply across the overall market, I envisage.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that's an interesting thing. Now, obviously, you know, these stats are going to change and we'll need to keep an eye on it, but that's kind of an indication I get that it's going to be positive news for the property market over the next 18 months to 3 years in terms of that scenario. Now, some other headlines. Opal Tower.
Yes.
Everyone remember the story around that one? Yep. The one Christmas Eve where everyone had to vacate from cracking and movement?
Yep. Yes.
Well, it's actually had one of the apartments in the building has sold for the first time since that episode.
Really?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And believe it or not, the apartment sold for a profit.
You're joking.
Okay.
Really?
A 10th floor apartment sold for $950,000, which was $158,000 more than it sold for off the plan.
My goodness.
Wow.
So fascinating, really. Now, that's a one-off.
Who's the sucker?
Well, hard to say. Don't actually have that information. But it goes to show that if you get certainty about the rectification and the quality of the building, you would be comfortable to buy. Obviously, the media is always going to portray that it's doom and gloom and it's a big disaster.
Mm.
But someone's had enough comfort that the rectification works and the longevity of the building's good enough that they're willing to part with nearly $1 million.
Wow.
Related to that, and in the wake of that, and also there was the Mascot Tower in Sydney that had cracks as well in its car park.
Yep.
So New South Wales have appointed a new building commissioner to implement change to strengthen the construction industry foundations.
Okay.
So probably in the wake of a lot of this, they're saying, okay, we need to set higher standards and have a better oversight.
Yep.
So that's another appointment that's going to have an impact over time. New home sales are rising. So how we've mentioned that obviously the approvals for new homes is declining, stats are telling us that the sales of new homes is rising for the first time since 2017.
Right.
Okay. So up by nearly 1% on the previous quarter. And Victoria's led the way with a 5% increase for the June quarter.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
Hence the crystal balling scenario. If new home sales are on the increase and the supply of new homes is on the decrease, as long as populations continues to rise and, you know, people are still having access to money via jobs and credit, it has to have an impact on pricing.
Okay. Well, very interesting property news, Brad.
Yep.
Okay. I feel like I've got a time machine and I can see the future.
Wow. Let's hope.
Let's hope. I mean, look, you know, at the end of the day, you've got two sides to the market, right? You've got those who are first home buyers and looking to get into the market who would prefer prices to come down. and interest rates to remain low. And then you've got those who own homes that would and investors who own investment properties who would certainly appreciate an improvement in the value of their property.
Yeah. Mm.
So I guess it depends on what side of the market that you're coming from, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Well, there was actually one other piece of information I had in all this mix that I didn't mention. I thought I'll touch on it as well, that throughout the downturn we've had, how we've mentioned, you know, property's been in decline across the residential market in Australia for the last 18 months or so. So, so apartments have actually outperformed houses over the period of that downturn.
Right.
So, which is a bit surprising. Now, that doesn't mean that they've grown in value more. It just means that their rate of decline has been less than houses over the period of time. And as price growth starts to come in again, they're actually growing at higher rates than houses in the short term anyway.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Probably the main reason, if you look at it, is purely the affordability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, apartments are typically 20 to 50% cheaper than houses. Therefore, there's a lot more people that can afford it, a lot more activity likely to happen from investors and potentially owner-occupiers, first-home buyers.
Yeah.
So don't imagine that being a long-term trend, but it's an interesting stat over the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, most definitely. And also, I don't have broad statistics, but the examples I have seen of apartments, the rent yield has been a lot more attractive than on housing.
Very good. Yeah, I don't have that information either, Louis. Yep. But
so
it would make sense.
Yeah, I think with the amount of rent that apartments have been able to get, and especially now, if you can get a home loan that's in the threes and the rent yield is in the fours, well, it's now more affordable to own the apartment than it is to actually rent it.
Yeah.
So there's going to be people jumping out of the apartment rental market into the apartment ownership market and saving money because of it.
And that's true that typically apartments do yield slightly higher than housing. You know, if you were to buy a house for, say, $1 million, it might rent for $700-$800 a week. You buy an apartment for $800,000, it'll probably rent for the same.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Brett. Great information. We'll take another break. We'll be back soon.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And welcome back. Welcome back. Now it's my turn for my special topic.
You go. I
already talked about the financial advice industry.
You go, girl.
Bring it home. Hooray for me. I've just got a small topic today because we're coming into the time of year where people are putting in their tax returns.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm. So those people who are early are probably putting them in now. You've probably got your employer's group certificate now, although they haven't been called a group certificate for about a decade. I still call them a group certificate. It's a PAYG summary.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yes. Yep. But everyone knows what I'm talking about, surely. Yep. Anyway, so got me thinking, what would you ask your financial advisor about how you should use your tax refund? Because a lot of people will be getting $1,000 back, $2,000 back, $5,000 back.
TV, holiday.
Yeah.
Night out.
That's right. Well, it got me thinking the natural thing to do, which most people will do, it depends on what is your habit. And this came up in the debt series that I had about certain things being habit magnifiers, behavioral magnifiers. Mm. So if you already have a regular behavior around your finances, if you're already a spender, if you've got your tax refund, what are you going to do with it? You're probably going to spend it. And if you already have a savings habit, when you get your tax refund, there's a good chance that you will save it. So that's what most people will probably do.
Mm.
Whatever you're currently doing with your extra money is what you will probably do with your tax refund.
Yeah, makes sense.
So if you want to change your habits and change your financial behaviors, your tax refund is a great opportunity to have a rethink about what you want to be doing with your money in future.
Yeah.
I think it's a great opportunity to reassess what's important in your life, what you need in your current life, and where you want your future finances to be positioned. So the tax return itself, if it's an extra couple of $1,000s, is nice and is helpful, but it's only a small part of an overall financial plan.
Yeah,
but it is a great opportunity to make a change.
Yep.
To do something different.
Yep.
So if you're receiving your tax refund, just have a rethink about your plans for what you're going to use it for. I know a lot of people rely on that tax return for their yearly holiday.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. It's your money. You can spend it how you want.
Yeah.
That's my philosophy on money. But just always be mindful of where you're heading.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because for a lot of people, where they're heading is the same as where they are right now. With working a job and working a job indefinitely. And they don't have a retirement plan. They don't have a plan to accumulate more funds. And they're the people who end up with a relatively small amount of superannuation balance, which might last them 20 years of retirement before they are forced to be on the Centrelink pension.
Yeah.
Which is not a great existence.
No. And Louis, as you say, habit, we're trying to either change or form a habit here, and they take some time to form. So the sooner you get started, if you've got a goal, the better.
Yep.
I remember Warren Buffett had a saying, was it, the chains of habit are too light to feel until they're too heavy to break?
That's true.
So it's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
So if you don't know what your habits are, you need to start paying attention and then making a concerted effort to change.
Yep, exactly. So if I could make one suggestion, it would be to use your tax refund as a resource to reassess. You can use that money to engage a financial planner, or you can use that money to buy yourself some time in some way. I've talked in past episodes about employing someone like a housekeeper to clean your house, which should free up a few hours each week, which gives you a few hours to do something more more valuable with your time. And if you're not putting any time towards working on your finances, then it's a great opportunity to use the money to create time to put your attention where it should be.
Agreed.
And that's it from me.
Ah, short one from you, Louis.
Yeah, short one from me, but valuable.
Absolutely.
If I do say so myself. Well, something else which is valuable every week. Thank you, Brett. What do you have to be serious about this week?
I've got a couple of things. One I thought was quite bizarre. Canadian police were doing a Facebook live stream of a serious matter, and unbeknownst to the police department, they were live streaming with the cat filter on.
Was this a Snapchat filter or something?
So what it means, and I haven't used it, but apparently when you live stream via some of the social media outlets, there's filters that you can put on that put overlays over the image, and the cat filter had the police commissioner there with cat's ears trying to portray a very serious message. And before I give you guys a go, I have to mention this one. The world's most expensive phone call was made yesterday by someone in our office.
Oh, yeah. I saw that, Bill. I almost died.
What happened?
So our phone provider issued us with a bill yesterday for $8.2 million.
You cannot be serious.
Wow. So when we queried it, we got to the bottom of it. So obviously we've got a VoIP service, not the old copper lines. It's an internet-based service, and it's software-driven with how they log all the calls. and they'd changed their international calling rates, and we'd made a call overseas from the office here for 4.2 minutes at approximately $1.68 million per minute. So when that updated their rates, they'd either put a decimal point or something in the wrong place. Because of the automated software, it blew our bill out to $1 million.
And we got cut off as well, didn't we?
We did get cut off because of that, yeah, being way above the credit limit.
Wow.
The guy on the phone was willing to negotiate it down to 4.2. So not often you get a $4 million savings in half an hour.
Very good, very good. Gentlemen, I hate to push your pain points and remind you of the fact that Collingwood has lost four of the last five games.
The Big Short.
Yes.
What was our last win again?
It was against West Coast. Spare a thought for what has been called the UK's worst pro football team.
Mm. Oh.
They had a 73-match winless streak.
Oh, wow.
Which is finally over.
Hey.
They broke their winless streak.
A forfeit?
Good for them. No, it wasn't a forfeit. But in soccer, they had a goal differential of minus 221 in the last 73 matches. And they it was a losing streak stretching back 2.5 years, 840 days. Wow. So good on them. They finally got a win.
Gents, how would you feel if you have ordered some plus-size clothing online from your favourite fashion store?
Well, I wouldn't feel good if I'm ordering plus-size.
No.
And
a bit self-conscious.
And your favourite fashion store decided to put a surprise little present in there.
Well, that's
Atkins
okay.
Diet Bar.
Oh.
Forever 21. Forever 21 have been sending nice little packages of Atkins Diet Bars to their plus-size women who have been ordering clothes online as a surprise gift. Oh, a nice bonus gift. Who was the person who thought of that?
Yeah.
And how did that get approved?
Yeah.
Ooh. Wow.
Oh, I'm speechless. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
I'll give it a you can't be serious on the fly, one that I've read before.
Yeah.
A US clothes retail online shopping. Someone did order a plus size. I think it was a size 16 skirt.
Yes.
The retailer realized they were out of size 16, so they put in the package two size 8 skirts. And he said, there you go.
With some needle and thread.
Oh, jeez.
Crazy.
Oh, my goodness. Anyway, thank you, listeners. I hope you enjoyed that last bit.
We did.
We enjoyed the whole episode.
Please come back, Steph.
Kick us in line. We'll catch you again next week.
Thanks, Louie.
Bye.
Thanks, guys.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.